أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. فلما أحس عيسى منهم الكفر قال من أنصاري إلى الله؟ قال الحواريون نحن أنصار الله، آمنا بالله واشهد بأننا مسلمون. ربنا آمنا بما أنزلت واتبعنا الرسول فاكتبنا مع الشاهدين. ومكروا ومكر الله والله خير الماكرين. Yesterday we discussed in some detail the verse 53, لما أحس عيسى منهم الكفر. Later on, when I returned, I thought of two other very important reasons why this declaration is made, this call for help is made by prophets. You know the background why this question is being discussed. The question is, I repeat, that when Allah does everything for bringing about the final, ultimate victory of all the messengers and messages which He has been sending, then why should there be a call and with such a panic that whoever wants to be the helper of Allah should come and join me? So in this regard, there are two other very important points which have to be brought to your notice. Number one, that just faith is not enough to reform someone. Sacrifices play a very important role after the faith in the reformation of individuals and the peoples. So if anybody is given a victory ready-made from on high, in which he has not to participate for earning the victory, that victory in fact would be, instead of being a boon to him, may become a source of destruction for him. In fact, such victories do not reform, they rather help deteriorate the character of such people who are given something without their own personal participation. This is why the generations which do not have to earn with their own blood, toil and sweat, but who were bequeathed large wealth by their forefathers, they generally tend to dissipate it and spend it in wrong causes. They don't know the value. So this is why all the followers of prophets are made to pass through the mill of persecution and sacrifices, and they are made to participate in the victory which is to be given to them anyway by God. But for their own sake, this is the best way they attain that victory. Otherwise, that victory be of no avail to them. This is why instead of, in another place in the Holy Quran, we find this concept of victory without the participation of the people roundly condemned in the Holy Quran, in the strongest possible terms. For instance, it is reported in Al-Ma'idah 25 that when Moses was told by God to enter with his people a certain city, which according to God was ready to receive them, only they had to enter. And the people there who were afraid to join him, they said, "Izhab anta wa rabbuka faqatila wa inna hahuna qaidun." O Moses, if victory is that easy, then go forward, you and your God, and conquer the town for us, and we are waiting. We wait here. So when you have conquered, then we'll follow, of course. So the condemnation was so strong that even Moses had to suffer for their crime. And the victory which had been promised them within 40 years was postponed to another 40 years. So this is the importance of participation. And any concept which is against this is wrong, is irreligious. Secondly, and this is from the point of view of reformation of one's conduct and moral standards, etc. As far as the faith is concerned, pure faith, that also is benefited by this participation. Because there are two types of faith possible. Number one, a faith in which there is a shadow of doubt, and yet someone overcomes those lingering doubts and suspicions and decides to join the caller for Allah, the party of the prophets, etc. He decides to join forces with the prophets despite the fact that there is still some shadows of doubt which have not yet been dissolved. This is one type of faith. The other faith is the faith after victory, when everything has become evidently clear. And the Holy Quran itself raises the question and says the faith of those people who belong to the earlier period, when there was still a shadow of doubt as to the truth, and when even the victory was not certain, their faith is beyond all comparison in quality and everything to those who follow later on, when the victory has been granted by Allah to such people. That is one reference. And in another place, you find Iman bil Ghaib, right in the beginning of the Holy Quran. If a victory is granted by Allah directly, without the participation of the people, where would be the Iman bil Ghaib? Then that is only Iman bi Shahada. Everybody would know that God is doing it. Nobody else is moving in any direction. Still they are being carried as if on the shoulders of somebody else to victory from place to place. They go on advancing towards the ultimate goal without even moving a foot. So what sort of faith that would be if people believe in such a thing? That is no belief. That is just seeing and believing. That is a completely different thing than the belief, the concept of belief which the religion produces, and in which belief is also to be rewarded. If you see a monarch in his full glory and submit to him and join forces with him for the sake of drawing benefits from him, that belief in such a monarch or submission to such a monarch is not to be rewarded. I mean, this is a natural act. Nothing else is expected of you, otherwise you will be a mad person. So that faith which earns favors of Allah, which is rewarded, such that faith always has a shadow of doubt lingering somewhere. This is why in the very opening sentence of the Holy Quran it says, يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ. And this is why Hazrat Masih Maud al-Islam has discussed this aspect at length by telling us that every prophecy of a prophet always has this element, so that when a prophecy comes to pass, there are those who say, no, that was the reason that happened, this and like that, and they try to search for natural causes or search for evidence which would make them believe that it was, even if God had not told such a prophecy to his the claimant of prophecy, still he could have access to such predictions and so on. So they say sometimes the time was ripe for Arabia, for instance, the Orientalists say. And the prophecies which he made of the victory of Islam were based on philosophical study of things. There are always times in the nation's history where they reach a turning point. And political seers also can predict a change. So if somebody with a brilliant brain had seen through all this, like Hazrat Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam did, no wonder that could happen. So such discussions are found by way of explanation as to why Islam became victorious and why prophecies about the victory of Islam were made if there was no contact with God. So that is why Nusrat al-Allah plays a very important role for the reformation of the people who believe and for enhancing the quality of their faith. If this phenomenon was ignored by God or declared unnecessary, then such a people would be meaningless. They won't achieve anything by accepting a prophet. Neither they will be improved morally, nor will their faith have any quality of excellence to be rewarded. In view of all this, I point out to you a fact that Jesus Christ particularly have been chosen to make this declaration of Ansari Allah. And it has been repeated in the Holy Quran, so it must have a significance for the future. By understanding this, what I have already told you, now you discover the significance also very clearly. He was to repeat his visit. And different things were to be ascribed to him during his repeat visit, both by the Christians and by the Muslims. This time they would begin to believe he would not come. Pardon? Noise or voice? This is not my fault. Why didn't you tell me before? All right. I didn't know what I was talking about. Would you come forward, please? Squeeze a little bit so that those who don't find room here, standing outside, they can come in as well. I'm sorry, Dar Sahib, I can't repeat all that I've already said, but to apprise you of what has been said in a few sentences, I was discussing two more aspects of the reasons why prophets like Jesus Christ make a public call for help. Ansari ilallah is a call made by Jesus Christ which seems to have a connotation of crisis about it, a situation of urgency. Already many people have believed in him, and mostly he's addressing those who already believe in him. So he tells them that come and join me as Ansar ilallah, those who help towards the cause of God. In the background of the discussion which we held yesterday, I was raising two more points. One was that without participation in a noble cause, without offering sacrifices for a noble cause, people are not reformed by faith alone. Faith must be followed by participation. And that participation under adverse circumstances is the most important curative factor in the spiritual diseases from which people suffer before the reformers come. So if that call had not been made, people who believed in Jesus Christ would not have been reformed. And that is also the situation at the time of every prophet. Most important role in Reformation is played by sacrifices. And Jamaat Ahmadiyya today is a witness of all this. Secondly, the faith is meaningless if there is no shadow of doubt and everything is clear and evident. If somebody says, I believe in the Son, so I must be rewarded, people would send him as a reward to some mental home maybe, but no reward would be given to him. So if a faith is so evidently clear, I mean a call to a faith is so, it has such evidence as, you know, like the sun appears and there is no further evidence required, then to have a faith is no longer a quality of excellence. It's an ordinary affair of everyday life. So if Allah, instead of following this plan of calling for participation of everybody with the prophets, had told them to sit tight and God had designed to impose victory upon them, and their, I mean bring gifty to them as gifts and impose victory on their enemies, then everybody would know that there is a God and there is no further evidence required. So the faith of those who join forces with prophets when things are still in doubt, that improves the quality of faith and declares, and for not only improves the quality of faith, but also makes it an act which should be rewarded by God. On the converse, I told them, previously, I mean, I'm particularly addressing Dar Sahib, I hope he is listening to it this time, that God has strongly condemned even the thought of such a victory in which the followers of prophets were not to participate. And I pointed out a verse from Surah Maida 25, which tells us that when the doors of a city were about to be opened for Prophet Moses and his followers, and he was told by God to enter the town, unfortunately for those who had believed in him, they took this stance that, well, if the victory is so destined, why should we participate? Why should we risk our lives or confront any dangers whatsoever? So they said, Izhab anta wa rabbuka fa qatila wa inna hauna qaidun. Go ahead, you and your God, and become victorious, get the keys of the town, and then call us and we'll join you. This was so strongly condemned by God that the victory, which had been promised them within 40 years, was postponed to another 40 years. And even the righteous had to suffer along with these stupid people who took this stance. Moses also suffered. So that is an expectation which is very strongly condemned in the Holy Quran. So Ansari Ilallah Tahriq, the movement and the general call for joining forces with prophets for the sake of ultimate victory of a religion, is highly essential both for improvisation of one's moral and spiritual conditions and as well as for the improvement of the quality of faith. In fact, without it, faith doesn't mean anything whatsoever. Now, applying these two things to the second coming of Jesus Christ, any concept of Jesus Christ's second coming which negates these two fundamental principles is wrong. because they are the fundamental principles which hold good on the testimony of the entire past history of prophets. On the touchstone of that history, if you apply these two principles, the answer would be yes, they are never-changing principles. They are eternal, they are universal. So if Jesus comes this time negating these fundamental principles, he would be either violating the inviolable laws of God, or he will be negating his own first coming. His first coming would appear to be stupid in comparison to his second coming. If this was the real victory which he was to brought this time without the participation of the people, why didn't he think of it the first time? You know, too late in life for him to reform and ultimately think that no, the first method was wrong and it was just exercise in futility, so why not this time come with the grandeur so that everybody looks at me and believes and there is no trial involved in this and no participation of the poor people. Why should they suffer? Why should they go to caves? Why should they be put to the lion's cages and so on and so forth? So these are the two most important reasons why call for help is made by the prophets as made by Jesus Christ. And by him more emphatically, because his future coming was to suffer with the wrong conceptions attached to that future coming. So his emphasis on Ansari Ilallah Tahriq makes it clear to us that if he comes again, he would do the same thing. And it is wrong of anybody to expect anything contrary to his first behavior, first conduct. Another point which I thought I missed yesterday was about Shahada, the second verse. Rabbana amanna bima anzalta wattabana rasula faktubna ma shahideen. Shahideen in this context may also mean, and in fact I should say it does also mean, those who bear witness to the oneness of God. For this we have the authority of the verses which has already passed. I refer to the verse which says, شهد الله أنه لا إله إلا هو والملائكة وأولو العلم قائما بالقسط لا إله إلا هو العزيز الحكيم. This verse defines shahada in a very particular way. It says God has borne witness, he has become shahid, that he is one. And all along with him, this testimony is borne by angels and ulul ilme qaimam bil qist, and those people of knowledge who are righteous in their acts. So shahada here of God and of angels and of these righteous people refers to the shahada of oneness of God and unity of God. So because it just befits here in this context, because it was Jesus Christ who was ultimately considered to share Godhood with him and was to be turned into a sort of literal or whatever sort of son, as he was turned later on by his followers. So this is so appropriate here that God taught his followers this prayer, that, O Lord, count us among among those who bear witness to your oneness, and differentiate us from those who follow later on, and who commit the mistake of calling partners along with you, and considering Jesus Christ in any way or any form to be a partner in your Godhood. Godhead or Godhood, what would be the correct English word for its infinitive? Godhood. Yes. So anything which is, which claims share for Jesus Christ in Godhood of God is rejected by this verse in the form of a prayer which God taught his earlier people. And so a distinction is made between the early period of Christianity from that of the later period. And these people are exonerated, the first disciples. This is the beauty of this verse. This exonerates not only Jesus, because this is exactly the context, you know, he begins by saying that God is one. Where was I? Let me see. The verse which we're discussing. Just two verses before, there was a verse reading, إِنَّ اللَّهَ رَبِّي وَرَبُّكُمْ فَابُدُوهُ هَذَا سُرَاطُ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, that Jesus said, this is God, my Lord, and your Lord. Worship Him and Him alone. هَذَا سُرَاطُ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, this is the right way to which I am calling you. So Allah exonerated him in this verse from any idolatry, concept of idolatry which was attached to him later on. So in this respect, what was the position of his followers? Were they also exonerated? This verse exonerates them as well. فَاكْتُبْنَا مَا شَهَدِينَ, when it is understood as those who bear witness to your oneness, on the authority of the previous verse, of course, exonerates the first generation of his followers. So if St. Paul said anything contrary to these two fundamental statements of the Holy Quran, then either St. Paul was wrong, or those people who attributed these things to him were wrong. There is no third possibility. Then the entire onus of idolatry would be shifted from the first generation of Christians to St. Paul and St. Paulians later on. Makaru wa makarallah wallahu khairul makirin. And Jesus' enemies planned, and Allah also planned, and Allah is the best of planners. Here the word makaru is translated as planned, but the word has a much wider connotation. Makar generally is understood in a bad connotation. Primarily, most often it is applied to a situation where something is plotted and a plot is being hatched, and it has that connotation of evil about it, which has caught the attention of many commentators, non-Muslim commentators in particular, and also the Muslim commentators have tried to defend the position of the Holy Quran vis-à-vis this. The Orientalists have alleged that the concept of God which the Holy Quran presents is that of a mean plotter who slyly designs things and who has not the boldness of openly fighting the enemies and defeating them. So makar also has a connotation of weakness about it. Those people who are weak, who cannot achieve something with in direct confrontation, sometimes they go underground and through designs and plottings, they try to achieve that object which they could not otherwise openly. So this is something very bad, which if attributed to God. So they have harped on this aspect of the word makar. Similarly, in the more recent past, the Aryas, so-called Aryas from among the Hindus, have particularly attacked Islam through this window of makar. And they have used absolutely shockingly filthy language against the Holy Prophet and God, etc., by saying that he was such a mean plotter and this and that, and this is the result of such thinking. And so Hazrat Masih Maud alayhi salatu wasalam had to take up the cudgel for Islam against them, and very strongly and effectively, and destroy the enemy when they attacked Islam from this head as well as from others. But in Brahini Ahmadiyya you would find reference to this, and also in other books of Hazrat Masih Maud alayhi salatu wasalam, where he defends Islamic values against attacks by Aryas particularly. The position taken by Hazrat Masih Maud alayhi salatu wasalam and proved on the authority of Arabic dictionary is that makar is a neutral word. Makar means a very delicate and subtle design. Initially, this is what the word makar means. And the subtlety of a stratagem is the central feature of the word makar. It can be employed both rightly and wrongly. And in case of the makar of God referred to in the Holy Quran, the Holy Quran is very explicit about it. It leaves no shadow of doubt about to what sort of makar God used, because makaru wa makar Allah, they planned or they plotted, and God counter-plotted. Wallahu khairul makirin. God's plots are always on the good side, never in the evil side. They belong to the area of goodness, not to the area of evil. So, if any doubt was entertained by the first statement, that was clarified by the same verse in the following part of the same verse. Because it ends up by saying, Wallahu khairul makirin. The word khair has been translated by some scholars as more powerful planner, while the word khair contains khair as the essential part of it. Victory or strength can be attributed to khair through logical conclusion, not directly. Khair does not mean victorious or the quality of strength. But khair means an excellence in quality itself. So when Allah says, Allah khairul makirin, all wrong notions about his makar are dispelled with one stroke. What was the makar? And why Allah uses the word makar to counter it? Now, before I ask the first part of the question, let me turn to the second part. Why should Allah at all use the word makar, which also has a wrong, evil connotation about it? The fact is, there are many lessons in this style of Allah's expression. Number one, if somebody wrongs you, you have a right to take your revenge to that degree. and use the same weapons of offense in your defense, and that is not morally wrong. So to that degree, this verse also gives us sanction that if somebody has wronged you, although normally in ordinary situation you will never go to that extreme of punishing your enemy, but if you do that, having first been offended in a particular way, then God absolves you of responsibility, of answerability to Him in this regard. He would say, all right, you were wrong, but to that extent you had a right not to go beyond that. So the word makar also indicates a countermeasure of the same style which the enemy has initiated. Secondly, the word makar has a connotation of subtlety about it, and God's plan and a secrecy about it. And God's plans are always secret in this regard. They move subtly, and people generally don't take notice of them. When they come ultimately to be disclosed, when they come to surface, then people suddenly realize that something has happened. And according to the expression of the Holy Quran, وَلَا تَهِينَ مَنَاسِ, then for the enemy, there is no way of escape left. God's plans surround people, surround the enemy, leaving them no room for escape. So that always has an element of surprise about it. So the quality of secretiveness is always in the plans of God, not in the evil sense, but as an expression of beauty. Like the element of surprise in all battles and wars is considered by those who know the art of fighting as a beauty, not as a wrong measure or an evil necessity. Surprise is the most important feature of warfare strategy. And it is considered to be an excellent feature, not a bad feature at all. So makar in this regard has a quality of surprise about it, and all Allah's plans have that quality of surprise. Thirdly, it is an irony on the people who use makar, and they ultimately find themselves trapped in the same traps which they prepared for the enemy. Makar also has a connotation of somebody falling into his own traps. And when Allah uses this word, generally this means that the enemy prepares a plan, a secret plot to destroy a prophet or his followers. And most often than not, it happens that their own strategy ultimately begins to work against them, to hit back upon them. And makar has that quality about it. Allah's makar in this particular regard. Now let's turn to the second part of the question, or the first part of the question I raised, and which has been agitating also the minds of classical commentators. That is, what was the makar here to which the Holy Quran is referring? What makar did the Jews commit, and what was actually the counter-makar of God? So then we'll understand it better in the light of what actually happened, the meaning of makar, All the commentators are agreed on this aspect, that the makar to which the Holy Quran is referring here, regarding the enemies of Jesus Christ, was the makar of their plotting to murder Him. They plotted to murder Him, and a regular plan was prepared so that the Roman, governor of the Roman Empire was convinced that he is not being prosecuted for religious differences alone, but he is an enemy of the state. So to make Jesus Christ appear as the enemy of state, that was the makar. That is not what the commentators have written, but what I said was, they agree that the plot to murder Jesus Christ was referred to as makar. If this plot simply meant that they opposed him on the principle that he was a fake prophet or, false prophet, so they had a right to murder him according to the teachings of Torah. That is not makar. That is just a simple and straightforward attempt to punish a criminal. That they could not do. So to circumvent this difficulty they faced, because the kingdom did not belong to the Jews, that belonged to the Romans, I am suggesting that makar must have referred to that plot in which Jesus Christ was made to appear as a rebel to the Romans. And that was the main debate you find mentioned in the New Testament in the presence of Pilate. This is why Jesus Christ, when he was asked as to whom did he think the sovereignty belonged, that sort of question, question to that effect, he said, my teaching is, he took a sovereign in his hand and said, whose picture is on one side of this foreign sovereign? He said, it is that of Caesar. He said, this is my teaching. What belongs to Caesar, give to Caesar. What belongs to God, give to God. So there is no violation of rules and no confrontation with Roman Empire, and I am a loyal subject of this country. So the enemies were nonplussed. But the plot was about to succeed. Despite this victory of Jesus Christ in logical arguments, because of the weakness of Pilate, he could not withstand the pressure of the Jews, and he thought there would be a lot of commotion for the sake of one person, so he let him hang even if he is innocent. So the plot still was about to be succeeded. Then Allah came in, and then he frustrated the plot. Here begins the second part of this very interesting drama. According to the earliest scholars, and most fortunately, most of them are agreed on that too, the counterplot of Allah was to save Jesus Christ by lifting him to the heaven bodily and giving his shape to somebody else. And everybody has, according to his own ingenuity, presented some interesting story as to what happened actually. Because each commentator has his own story to offer without any reference to any historical book, so he was free to do whatever he pleased. There was no evidence whatsoever. So they conjectured. They said, perhaps this happened, and they thought, this appeals more to my mind, so may it appeal to my readers as well. So one of the stories was that there were 12 disciples. They were all gathered together with Jesus Christ in one house. One of them was a hypocrite. He reported the presence of Jesus Christ to the authorities. So God had a good opportunity to unroll his makar. That is, he immediately gave that disciple the shape of Jesus Christ who had reported his presence. So this is Khairul Makirin, they say. What a beautiful counter-planning. the munafiq who had reported, he was immediately given the shape of Jesus Christ, and the archangel took Jesus, and because the roshandan, what is it called, the light panel above, skylight, yes, because the skylight was, well, the light was large enough to permit them exit through that. So angel took Jesus Christ and immediately disappeared through the skylight. So the poor man who had reported was left to be, you know, to be sacrificed on his behalf. So they say, so sleeper mara gaya, poor thing, was ultimately had to pay with his life on cross. But apart from this, there are other commentators who have attempted to attribute this word makar to some other action of God. But unfortunately, there too they have made some grave mistakes, historical mistakes. For instance, some of them have referred to the persecution of the Jews at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar as makar of God. That took place some 100 years ago. How many years ago? Before Jesus Christ, I mean. 70 years? No. Nebuchadnezzar punished the Jews in before Christ, not after. 70 years after Jesus Christ, it was a Roman king, Titus, who punished, not this Persian king. So this commentator Ishaq, Muhammad bin Ishaq, says that that Persian king, Ben Nebuchadnezzar, punished the Jews for the crime of ill-treating Jesus Christ and his followers, and this action had taken place many years before. I don't remember exactly. Some 100 years, I think it was. 200 some. 400? I see. Anyway, I mean, that is immaterial. It happened definitely before Jesus Christ was born. Imam Razi has also suggested that the word makar is sometimes used to indicate jazaul makar, that the when somebody's evil is requited by punishment, that punishment is sometimes referred to as makar, and the word of crime is repeated to indicate the punishment. According to Imam Razi, this is the style of Arabic which has been adopted in the Holy Quran. For instance, he quotes another verse which is also again debatable. يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسَهُمْ. That also is a verse in which, in fact, is largely debated, which means they attempted to deceive God and those who followed, who believed in him or believed in the Prophet. وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسَهُمْ. And they don't deceive but themselves. Referring to this, in another place, Allah says, "Wallahu khadi'uhum." It is Allah who deceives them. So, according to Imam Razi, this verse, "Yukhadi'uhum yakhda'una illa anfusahum," solves the mystery for us as to how Allah deceives them. makes them fall into their own trap. This is what I said earlier. This is one of the meanings of this makar. If people who plot against somebody are made to fall into their own traps which they have built for someone else, this is a befitting punishment for such people, to turn their makar against them. And when it is said that Allah did the makar, that meant that Allah turned their makar against themselves. Musi Maud already referred to incidentally, I again refer to the verse يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسَهُمْ, because it has also a message for us. In this verse it is said مَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ, they plotted against God. So the God had a right to counterplot, I mean a moral right. So in that verse it is said, يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. So if God had a right to counterplot, why not those believers against whom a plot was made? They also had a right to plot, not only that, they have a duty to plot against them to the same degree, but in the style of God, not in their style. So if يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ should have sufficed, that was enough. Because يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ contained the everything belonging to God. Why وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا was repeated here was because to give the believers a right to counter the measures taken against them. And also to point out to them that it is not only their right, this is also their duty. So you can't leave things to God by saying that because they are يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ, so let him take the countermeasures. Allah says, وَيُخَادِعُونَ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, they are doing it to you as well. So you have a right to countermeasure. So these two countermeasures put together become the ultimately destroy and frustrate the enemy's plans. So call for Nasr, call for help also is better understood in the light of this. Yes, I think I have almost covered everything already. So, as far as today's commentary is concerned, I think we should leave it here.